Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we are immersing ourselves in a source that is raw, deeply personal, and, well, absolutely intense. We're kind of moving beyond the typical professional or political debates to analyze a true story. It's about profound, agonizing, interpersonal betrayal that played out in Phoenix, Arizona.
That's right. The main source we're looking at is Friendship Betrayed, a Phoenix testimony of deliverance. It's Ricky Zaccaria's first-person account. Harrowly stuff. He describes a 16-year friendship that, in his telling, spiraled into this nightmarish battle for survival, involving things like alleged witchcraft, organized harassment, psychological torment, and it apparently culminated in attempted murder.
Yeah, it's a narrative that just hits you immediately with its severity. It really does. But our mission here isn't just to, you know, gawk at the shocking details, right? No. We want to dive deep, understand the core themes, profound betrayal, yes, but also resilience. And we're using a specific lens for this. Mm. We're applying concepts from an integrative framework called faith, betrayal, and resilience. Trying to give this very personal story broader meaning. Trauma-aware, spiritually grounded meaning.
Exactly. We want to see how an extreme case study like this kind of illuminates fundamental truths about trust, suffering, and the incredible lengths people sometimes go to survive and, well, rebuild.
Right.
It's about taking all that chaos and trying to apply some structure to understand it better.
Okay, let's unpack this. So the pain in this testimony, it's overwhelming. But it's not just about the attacks themselves, is it? It's the foundation being destroyed.
Precisely. Yeah. Ricky Zaccaria, the protagonist here, he had this deep 16-year bond with Harvey, who he names as the alleged perpetrator.
Yeah.
That history, that depth of trust, that's why everything that followed was so devastating.
Yeah, 16 years is a long time.
When trust is broken by someone who was, like, effectively family, it doesn't just hurt. It can really mess with your ability to judge reality. Because that person, you know, they held the keys to your sense of safety.
Right.
And the source doesn't describe it as just one bad event. It talks about what Zaccaria called the campaign of terror.
Wow.
Yeah, suggesting it felt organized, malicious, relentless, not just a falling out.
And the alleged attacks he documents, they escalated quickly, didn't they? Beyond just, like, arguments, we get into these overt claims of spiritual and psychological warfare. He talks about alleged witchcraft, creating this atmosphere of spiritual oppression. Then organized harassment, which he actually calls gang stalking and surveillance, and intense psychological mind games. He says that all of this basically shattered his sense of reality and safety in his own home, his own city.
And what's really interesting, or maybe disturbing, is how that initial interpersonal wound seems to quickly become existential. It spirals.
Yeah.
Now, to sort of categorize this experience, the framework we're using introduces some specific concepts. First, we look at betrayal trauma.
Oh.
That's the psychological wound that happens when people or institutions you really rely on for safety and survival, like a close friend, maybe a partner, even a workplace, violate that trust. It's trauma, but it's amplified because of that reliance.
Okay, that makes sense. But wait, you also mentioned moral injury earlier relating to Zaccaria's suffering. Isn't that term usually like for soldiers in combat or people who witness war crimes? How does it fit here in a civilian situation in Phoenix?
Yeah, that's a really critical distinction the framework makes. Good question. While moral injury often originates in combat settings, the concept actually applies to any situation where your deeply held moral beliefs are transgressed. It could be by something you did, something you witnessed, or even something you failed to prevent.
Oh, okay.
In Zaccaria's case, the alleged prolonged targeted malice from his lifelong friend. It essentially destroyed his fundamental sense of moral certainty, his belief about basic human decency, about trust.
Right.
That loss of knowing who's good, what's right, that deep, deep wound, that's moral injury.
Yeah. It's like his moral compass just got smashed. Okay. But let's tackle the really extreme claims for a second. The alleged witchcraft, the gang stalking. How does a modern integrative framework, one that uses psychological concepts, how does it handle allegations like that? Things that fall outside, you know, typical evidence-based categories. Does the framework say they're metaphors, or does it somehow incorporate them?
That really gets to the heart of the framework's integrative nature. It's a crucial point for anyone listening. The framework maintains neutrality on the, let's say, external validity of those claims.
Meaning
it doesn't try to confirm or deny if the supernatural stuff actually happened or if there really was organized harassment.
Okay.
Instead, it focuses entirely on the impact of Zaccaria's perception, on him, the survivor.
Mm-hmm.
If he believes he's under spiritual attack or constant surveillance, his body's response, his psychological response, It's basically identical to someone who is factually being stalked.
Gotcha.
So the framework provides tools, both spiritual disciplines and psychological coping mechanisms, to treat the fear, the anxiety, the hopelessness that results. What are the perceived cause?
So it validates the experience of the suffering without needing to validate the alleged source of it. That seems really important for healing.
Exactly. That clarity is vital.
But the experience wasn't just psychological, was it? It built up to this terrifying physical climax.
Absolutely. The narrative hits its terrifying peak with the account of a brutal beating and an explicit attempted murder. This was the ultimate test of survival. And in Zakaria's view, the absolute peak of the antagonist's alleged malevolence.
Okay. Here's where it gets really interesting. Zakari credits his survival not to, like, luck or just fighting back, but to two powerful non-traditional factors. First, he talks about the grace of God, a belief in direct divine intervention, protection from above.
Right. That's a core part of his testimony. And the second factor is, well, it's truly compelling. Maybe the most poignant detail in the whole account.
Right.
The protective intuition of his six loyal dogs.
Yeah.
The source specifically notes, their intervention, their intuition, was instrumental in saving him during the actual attack, like an animal defense mechanism kicking in.
It just adds this incredible layer of loyalty, even sacrifice, to what is otherwise this horrific story of, well, profound evil, as he describes it.
And if we look at this survival through the lens of the frameworks of theological components, the Kari's reliance on divine intervention and faith, it's a classic spiritual response to overwhelming adversity.
Right.
The framework actually encourages survivors to engage with theological themes, things like lament.
Lament, like complaining to God.
Sort of, yeah. It's the right to express grief, anger, protest to God. It's biblical. Then there's providence, the belief in divine care, even when it's hard to see. And crucially, theodicy.
Okay, wait, theodicy. That sounds like a big theological term. Can you break that down quickly for listeners?
Sure. Theodicy is basically the theological puzzle of how justice exists in the world, or, you know, how can a good and powerful God allow suffering and evil to happen? It's the problem of evil question.
Yeah. Ah, okay. The big question.
Exactly. And Zakari's narrative, by concluding with survival and reaffirmed faith, becomes his personal attempt to answer that agonizing question. His testimony is his answer, in a way, that there is ultimate hope, ultimate justice, even after the absolute darkest period.
However, the story forces us to remember that survival came at a terrible, terrible cost. After the attempted murder, after his physical recovery, the testimony recounts another just devastating emotional blow.
Mm-hmm.
The tragic death of those six loyal dogs due to alleged poisoning, which in the narrative just reinforces the malice attributed to the antagonist.
Yeah, that loss. The loss of those protective animal companions, the dogs, which the framework actually gives a term for, zanines. Kind of affectionately.
Zanines, like canines, but with an X.
Exactly. It's just a way to acknowledge their unique role.
Mm.
But the loss is profound and deeply isolating often. It's really noteworthy that this particular healing framework dedicates specific attention to this type of grief. It recognizes it often isn't fully acknowledged by society.
So are we talking about disenfranchised grief here?
Precisely. Disenfranchised grief is any grief that isn't openly acknowledged or socially supported. And that's so common with the loss of pets, right?
Right.
But especially when they were, like Zakari's dogs, literally instrumental in your survival.
Wow, yeah.
A framework really emphasizes honoring that loss through compassionate remembrance, maybe community care, recognizing that these deep necessary bonds exist beyond just human relationships.
This loss, coming after the survival, it seems like it really solidified Zakari's resolution, didn't it? He seems to move past just being a victim.
Yeah.
He survives, he spiritually reaffirms, and then he dedicates his book to God and his deceased pets. He transforms this horrific journey into a testimony, offering spiritual guidance, hope.
And that is the crucial step toward recovery, psychologically speaking. That very act of turning this awful experience into a spiritual testimony. It's a powerful form of meaning-making.
Meaning-making.
Yeah, narrative reframing. Instead of being defined solely by what was done to him, he starts to define himself by his survival, by what he learned, by his faith. That's the path towards what we call post-traumatic growth.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the integrative framework really aims to guide survivors toward.
So what does this all mean for us, for the listener? You know, maybe navigating our own betrayals, even if they're less dramatic than this story, we've used the framework to look at this really extreme narrative, right? Betrayal, spiritual warfare, divine intervention, loyalty, sacrifice, resilience, all these huge themes.
Yeah.
Now let's try to bridge that gap between this extraordinary case study and, like, everyday application.
Absolutely. The real value of the framework isn't just analyzing extreme stories, it's in its actionable practices. Mm. It teaches you how to manage the after effects of betrayal, whether it's from, I don't know, a friend, a family member, maybe even a business partner.
Yeah.
A primary takeaway is definitely the importance of setting strong ethical boundaries going forward. Understanding what you will and will not accept in relationships from now on. Being really clear about that for yourself.
And one of the most powerful distinctions I found in the source material, the framework stuff, was the difference between forgiveness, reconciliation, and release. Can we dig into that for a sec? Because I feel like that could be a game changer for someone feeling really stuck after a betrayal.
Oh, absolutely. It's huge.
Yeah.
So many people feel they have to forgive to move on, yeah. Right? Like it's a requirement.
Yeah, there's pressure.
But the framework carefully separates those concepts. Forgiveness is presented as an internal process. It's about releasing the emotional burden for yourself,
mm-hmm.
letting go of the bitterness, maybe. Reconciliation, on the other hand, that's a relational act. It's about reestablishing the relationship,
right?
Which, in cases of profound betrayal like Zachary's, is often impossible and frankly often unsafe or unwise.
Okay, so if forgiveness is internal and reconciliation is relational, what's release? How does that work practically for someone listening?
Release is where the actionable power often lies. It means you consciously detach your emotional future from the betrayer's actions or their fate.
Mm.
You acknowledge the harm? Absolutely. You process the grief. But you release the betrayer from having the power to control your ongoing happiness or peace of mind.
Mm.
You essentially decide their actions won't dictate your future well-being. And crucially, you don't owe your betrayer reconciliation just because you've maybe found personal forgiveness or release.
So you could forgive or release and still never speak to them again.
Exactly. You can wish them well from a distance, maybe, and maintain your boundaries. That's freedom.
That gives people permission, doesn't it, to move forward without feeling obligated to re-engage with the source of the trauma. That's powerful.
Precisely. And the end goal, really, of the framework is to help someone design a personalized, values-aligned resilience plan. This plan needs to blend whatever works for the individual. Maybe spiritual disciplines they rely on, prayer, meditation, community, combined with evidence-based coping mechanisms, things from therapy, maybe mindfulness, and always a practical safety plan if needed. The story of Ricky Zachary, as extreme as it is, really shows the absolute necessity of having that kind of robust, integrated plan when you're facing truly profound adversity.
It's a terrifying story, yes, but also powerful and ultimately kind of hopeful. How one man seemingly transformed profound malice into a journey of faith and recovery.
Yeah. And as we sort of wrap up this deep dive, Zachary's decision to publish his story, to make it a testimony, it does force us to consider the ethics around sharing such raw, harrowing personal accounts.
Mm, yeah.
We analyze the resilience, which is important, but there's a real complexity in healing so publicly, isn't there? How do we, you know, as a community, as listeners, evaluate the ethics of storytelling and representation, these really sensitive areas?
Yeah.
How do we make sure we avoid exploitation, that we uphold dignity, both for the storyteller and those mentioned, while still allowing space for people seeking deliverance and recovery through sharing?
Right.
That's a really powerful question, maybe something for you, the listener, to mull over, especially as you consider the path of post-traumatic growth, either for yourself or for others. How do we share these stories responsibly?